Welcome back, friends. My name is Emily Thomas, and I am your host, and this is the Mom Struggling Well podcast, the podcast that helps you love your actual life so that you do not need to run away from home. So this week, ladies, there's a boy on the podcast, but it's about mental health. You know I love talking about mental health. A lot of you do as well. So this week, we're going to talk about mental health and our children. Before we get started, though, I want to say thank you to the new patrons we have. We have some new Strugs. And I want to say thank you and hello to Susan, Angie, Alice, Wendy, Jessica, Taylor, Rachel, Marsha, and Kayla. We are so, so excited that you've decided to join us. If anybody else wants additional podcasts, two of them a month, and a super secret Facebook group where we go more in depth about the topics covered each week, then join us at patreon.com/momstrugglingwell. We are going to try something new. I don't know exactly when. I'll have to ask Katie. Katie knows everything about the schedule. But we are going to be interviewing some of the Patreon Strugs, and I'm really excited to share them with you because I love this Mom Struggling Well community. So there's so much going on in the world right now. All the protests that are happening, and I think it doesn't matter who you are. There's some really strong feelings evolved, as there should be. And I think a way to struggle well is to seek to understand and learn and pray. It just is heavy. It's a heavy time. And I think a lot of it's good. I think we're seeing a lot of ickiness too. So I think, I don't know. I don't have anything good to say except, hey, if you're feeling this is difficult, me too. I wanted to tell you about a book I just listened to on Audible. It was read by the author, and I liked that. The author's name is Ta-Nehisi Coates, and it's called Between the World and Me. CNN named it one of the most influential books of the decade. It's a Pulitzer Prize finalist. It is written from a Black man to his Black son. And again, like I said, read by the author. I would recommend it if you're short on time. I like listening to books, but I also just purchased White Fragility. It's on my nightstand, and since I just got done with this book, I'm starting that one. Some of y'all on Instagram were asking me for resources. I don't really think that anybody doesn't know where to find resources. It feels like there's a lot of resources being shared right now, but I just wanted to share with you the one I just read or listened to, Between the World and Me, and the one I'm about to start called White Fragility. So I'll be telling you about that here pretty soon. All right, let's go ahead and get started on my chat with Matt. Good morning, Matt. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. How has staying home forever been for you?
It's getting a little old. So it's okay, though. It's okay.
You have several kids. How many? Four? Three?
I have four kids, but one is 24 and lives on her own in another city. She's a social worker, but I have three boys here at home, two that are in college and one that's in the eighth grade.
Oh, man. Okay. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am the CEO of the Hope and Healing Center, an institute in Houston, Texas. We're a comprehensive mental health care resource for Houston. We offer a full set of psychiatric and psychological services for people who have serious mental illness, as well as we do training in faith communities so that they can do a better job of identifying people who have mental health problems and serving them, and then also connecting them with professional services. So people in psychological distress are more likely to go to clergy before they go to a mental health care provider or a physician. And so, you know, that's really the best place for us to kind of connect with them. And the majority of people with mental health problems in the U.S. receive no treatment. So if we can connect with them earlier, know where they go first, which is something the National Institutes of Health have found, perhaps we can get them to care. Plus, faith communities are a great place for people to recover. It's a loving environment, a loving therapeutic community where people can walk along with you. So it's really kind of the perfect place for people with mental health problems.
Yeah. What have you found when you go to faith communities and talk about mental health?
First off, that they don't really do much of anything right now. Most pastors don't realize that people are more likely to go to them first. Less than 10% of pastors ever make a referral So it's a, you know, it's a pretty unlikely thing for them to do. And they don't have anything in place. I mean, you know, some offer support groups, but not most churches don't. And so, you know, most of them are, they recognize that they're being kind of overwhelmed by these situations. They have a lot of people, they can immediately name off several people, this person, that person, and or I had this happen, and they just didn't know what to do. So most are very open. They want to help people. They're seeing it more and more. And so they're excited about the opportunity for training and resources. There is a small subset of Christian faith communities where it's over-spiritualized. I know it's looked at as a sin or a spiritual weakness. And so they're not particularly interested in talking to me, but that's okay. That's, you know, the majority are very open to it. Right now we're in 92 congregations around the Houston area and growing every day. And we've trained over 2,000 clergy. And so it's, you know, it's going very, very well.
Okay. When you talk to someone who over-spiritualizes it, because I think the listeners of the show are all over the spectrum of all that, but where can you point to in the Bible where this would be like, no, this actually is a thing. This isn't a weakness. They aren't just bad and to be avoided.
I mean, first off, you have to understand that a mental health problem is it's a physical problem. It's a physical illness. I mean, you have a brain, you know, and it's an organ and it can be damaged. I think a lot of times we kind of forget that. We really ignore our brain. I mean, if you have a liver cancer, you tend to not look at that as a spiritual issue. But the mental health problems are the only medical conditions in which the damaged organ has to make all the decisions for care.
Oh, so, it
really kind of messes everything up, you know? And so, the other thing is it's thoughts and feelings and behaviors, and people think of that as very ethereal and spiritual. You know, they don't think of that as physical or coming from a physical organ. And so they think, oh, well, you know, he did this and that is wrong, or she thought this and she just needs to stop believing the lie, or, you know, these kind of cliche-ish things that people say. So I think that that's the first thing. We have to understand that these are real conditions. And I mean, you've gone to school for a long time to get training in this area. I went to school for a long time to get training in this area. And to hear, you know, a pastor or a Christian kind of, you know, very flippantly just kind of dismiss it as if it's just kind of made up and not real is really insulting personally, but really naive and kind of stupid, frankly.
I mean, and dangerous too, when you say that to them.
And dangerous, absolutely. You know, you tell somebody to stop taking their medicine because you think that psychiatric medication shows a lack of faith in God's healing ability, you can kill them. And so, but you would never tell someone with cancer to stop getting their chemotherapy. So it's really treating organs differently. Now, that being said, I mean, you can look back historically. I mean, you look at somebody like Aristotle, I mean, who was an incredibly smart and learned man. Aristotle thought your brain was a heater that let, you know, heat off your body. And he thought you thought with your heart. So, I mean, that's why we still say things like you just broke my heart and things like that. And so, I mean, that's from Aristotle. He really thought it was, you know, meaningless. And really the term brain comes from an ancient word that really was a representative of fat. I mean, so people understand it. And if you look at the Bible never mentions the brain. It's never mentioned in the entire Bible. The ancient Hebrews and even the first century Jews and Greeks, they had no concept what the brain did. You know, where it says, for instance, you knit me together in my inmost beings, and it's talking about your kidneys and your intestines. I mean, the ancient rabbis thought that you had one good kidney and one bad kidney, and one was good emotions and one was bad. I mean, so they were all in. You know, they had all these kind of crazy ideas. I mean, that doesn't dismiss the truths of the Bible. It's just that they were describing the things that we believe today about our physical being, you know, 100 years from now, people laugh at, you know. And so, you know, they were describing it the best they could. So it's not just, you know, the brain isn't talked about, but mental illness and mental health problems are clearly described. I mean, they're not described, you know, using the same kind of terms we use, but they are clearly described. And the thing that I look at the most, and when I say to somebody, you know, who says that they're dismissive of it and they don't say they say it's not real, it's just a spiritual thing, I usually actually turn to the story of David when he is trying to hide from King Saul, and he goes and he hides in the Philistine country. And, it says he feigns insanity. I mean, it says he messed his hair up. He starts scratching on the gate. He's drooling on himself and he's acting all wild. And the soldiers recognize him and they recognize him as mad, is what it says. And then they take him to the king, and the king is actually angry at them. He says, "Do I not have enough madmen?" Because he knows that keeping David around because he's insane gives the king no honor to say, "I've defeated the great David," because everyone recognizes that this person he's insane. He's of no, you know, consequence anymore. So they kind of throw David out and, you know, let him go. And you can't feign what doesn't exist. And the other thing is that it obviously was so common at the time that he doesn't have to say anything. He just has to act that way. So clearly they recognize that these things occurred. And you can look through the scriptures and see lots of examples of behaviors that, you know, seem similar to some of the problems that we, you know, even look at some like Job as he deals with trauma. He shows a lot of the same kind of issues people with trauma today deal with. So these are human issues. God is present in them. You know, doesn't disqualify you from a relationship with God or make you any less spiritual. And so I think we just need to kind of be a little bit smarter as believers and kind of, you know, I think one of the big problems tends to be, and we all fall into this, is that we tend to think we have all the answers spiritually, when faith is full of mystery. And I think we have to be willing to say that we just don't fully understand it all.
Yeah. Yeah. And know that that's a humble strength. It's not a weakness to say that, because we don't understand. It's being in reality to say you don't know everything.
You know, how can we fully understand God? You know, we can understand aspects about him, but he's infinite.
Positive role models are critical to showing girls what's possible when they dream bigger. The award-winning Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls podcast offers parents and teachers a free resource to inspire, educate, and instill confidence in girls. The podcast draws from a library of stories in the Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls book series, which you've probably seen around. Each 20-minute episode highlights one exceptional woman, perfect for before bedtime or anytime you're in the car. Rebel Girls award-winning podcast has been named the best family and kids podcast by the Webby Awards. It was named the best educational podcast by the New York Radio Awards and rated the top educational podcast by iTunes. This podcast is made by Rebel Girls for Rebel Girls, which means it's told from a woman-first perspective, flipping the script on the textbooks, which have historically filtered the female experience through a male lens. Give the Rebel Girl in your life the confidence to dream bigger. Find Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls award-winning educational podcasts on your favorite player today. Okay, so you wrote a book called Grace for the Children, and it's about childhood mental illness. And that's something that's touched our family, and so it's dear to my heart. But for a mom who's listening, you know, this is our first time doing this whole motherhood thing, and sometimes we feel just as unable to know what to do if we're 20 years in as the first day in. And so when all kids are so different, how do you know if what you're looking at is, like, behavior wise or whatever, is an actual issue to be dealt with or just a quirky kid thing?
Right. Well, I think that's a great question. I think first we have to realize that, you know, normal in the kid world is a very big tent. You know, we tend to constrain it down to a very small, like, do these things, and if you fall outside of that, so you can behave quirky and odd and way out there, what we think on the extremes, and still be relatively normal. I mean, as a child, it's very, very wide, and then as you get older and older and older, and you have more responsibilities and more of a rigid structure around you, it's more narrow. So I think first off, you just got to kind of say, just because your kid's acting a little different doesn't mean they have a mental health problem. So just tell yourself that. I think next you do have to compare your child to other children, the average other child. You don't have to compare them to your perfect child, which I think is what a lot of people do, or the perfect child. You know, why can't you be more like Susie? You know, she already reads and she just was born last week, you know, kind of a thing. So, you know, you have to compare them to the average, you know, and if it's a 7-year-old boy, You have to compare him to other 7-year-old boys, not your 7-year-old daughter, or, you know, so, and make sure that as many factors are similar as possible. So when you talk to the teacher, you don't want to know if he's the worst in the class. You want to know, or if he, how does he compare to the average children that she's seen that are 7 years old over the last, 20 years, kind of thing. Because the class dynamic could be odd. It could just be generating him. So you want to, and you want to get more than one set of information. You want to talk to a Sunday school teacher. You want to talk to his teacher. You want to talk to his Boy Scout leader, who, you want to get multiple, and also I tell parents all the time, you're the parents. Better than anybody. You're with them more often. You see behaviors. And then I think you have to say, or the way that he or she behaves, or the way he or she thinks about things, is it affecting their ability to function? Does it affect their relationships with the family? Does it affect their relationships with other children? Is it affecting their ability to perform in school? Because that's really that's the measure of a disorder, is where you cross over a line and it impairs your function. I mean, lots of people are eccentric. Lots of people are odd, but they're able to do what they do every day. I mean, people probably say Bill Gates is kind of an odd guy, but he does what he does every day, kind of thing. And so, and again, I think it's not, are they doing what you want them to do? Mm. Are they able to do what the average 7-year-old child is able to do? I see children all the time that are held to these academic standards that are ridiculous. I often say that when I went to kindergarten, I'm 54 years old. So when I went to kindergarten, it was an option to go to kindergarten. Not everyone went to kindergarten. Now it's, everybody goes to kindergarten. It's the first year of school. Well, it was what do you think it's called? Kindergarten. It was an option at one time. And when I went to kindergarten, you did shapes and you did colors and you had fun. And, and so it was kind of what we think of as preschool today. There was no expectation of reading when you came out of kindergarten. No expectation. I mean, you might learn some letters, but nowadays there is a literal expectation of a certain reading level when a person comes out of kindergarten. And I have seen children that came out of kindergarten and weren't at that level labeled as learning disordered. Now, what changed? Did the children, is something wrong with the children, or do we change the expectation?
Yeah.
And so I think, if you've got your child if you have expectations for your child and you have them in an environment that holds higher expectations than the average child in America, I think you have to look and make sure you're not, saying, oh, well, my kid has ADHD because he can't sit still at the opera that I take him to every, even though he's 6, he should be able to do that. Well, I mean, that's unrealistic.
I think that's really good. It's really hard as parents to let go of preconceived notions that we had that we don't even realize we're holding on to.
Oh, absolutely. And, I see a lot of people that, teachers, and I'm not throwing teachers under the bus here, but, a teacher who's got 25 kids in a classroom, it's overcrowded, and they don't all come from backgrounds that are particularly good necessarily. And they spend more time disciplining than they do anything because they're trying to control this, this set of feral cats here. And they come to the teacher and they say, well, Johnny can't sit still in his desk. I mean, he's 6 years old. He can't sit still in his desk. And I think you might want to go get him checked for ADHD. That's just that whole scenario there is just atrocious and horrible. And then the parents, being good parents, they take their child to the pediatrician and they say, well, the teacher said she thinks he might have ADHD. And the pediatrician says, well, does he run around a lot? Does he talk a lot? Okay, well, here, let's try this. And they're now, Johnny is on the ADHD track when we have no idea if he has ADHD. No idea. He needs to be assessed by a mental health professional to determine whether he meets the criteria. You never put a child on medication unless they meet the criteria. But see, that kind of pathway, I would say the teacher kind of did something wrong, but nobody had a malicious intent there. They all wanted the best. But the reality is Johnny might not be able to sit in his seat. That doesn't mean he has ADHD.
Yeah. That's interesting. That you would say that people are sometimes over labeled or medicated
Oh, yeah. ADHD is way over diagnosed and way over prescribed. Medications or psychostimulants are way over prescribed, as are antidepressants. Antidepressants are way over prescribed in adults, you know, because people go, most people get their psychiatric medication from their primary care physician and that takes psychiatric medication. And so, you know, they go and they do a quick little, you know, couple of questions and they put you on antidepressant. And one thing people don't understand is, you know, if you're down and you take an antidepressant and you feel better, that doesn't mean you have depression. That just means the medicine worked. I mean, you know, I think people a lot of times go, oh, well, I have depression because, you know, I'm taking Zoloft, my primary care physician gave it to me, and I feel so much better. I mean, number one, I don't know that it was the medicine made you feel better. It might be the placebo effect, but it might have been the medicine. That still doesn't, you know, pharmacotherapy doesn't drive diagnosis. I mean, so you need to make sure you meet criteria. So if you think you have depression or your physician thinks you have depression, you need to go see a psychiatrist or a psychologist and be assessed. I mean, one of the things I say all the time to people is, you know, if you went to your primary care physician, which a lot of people do, because you felt some abdominal pain, and he or she sent you to get some imaging and did some blood work, and then they found out, oh my gosh, you got a big tumor in your liver. You know, and your primary care physician then says, oh, well, so I think you have liver cancer, so I'm going to start you on some chemotherapy. You would be like, no. Aren't there people that do that? You know, like they do cancer. Yes. In fact, aren't there people who just do liver cancer? Well, hey, you know what? There are people who just do mental health stuff and they just do mental health medications. And those are the things that we need. Again, it just shows how we kind of very naively treat mental health or psychiatric conditions, just like getting psychiatric medications for your child from their pediatrician. Do not get psychiatric medication for your child from your pediatrician. Get your pediatrician to refer you to a child and adolescent psychiatrist or a child and adolescent psychologist for mental health care for a child. It's just like them referring your child because they need their tonsils out.
A while back, I discovered Everlywell. It's the amazing at-home wellness test that helps you better understand your health. I received my Everlywell at-home lab test. I had tested myself for food sensitivities. I got my results back, and it turns out that says I'm sensitive to egg whites. I haven't experienced symptoms of that, but it's really good to know what I'm sensitive to in case it turns out to be a problem for me in the future. So Everlywell has more than 35 different at-home lab tests, from fertility to food sensitivity. You could even check your thyroid and your heart health. It comes with very easy to follow instructions. It's reviewed by a physician and the shipping is free. The cool thing is that after that, you get personalized, easy to understand results sent right to you. So to start better understanding your health like I did, check out Everlywell today. So for 20% off of an Everlywell at-home lab test, visit everlywell.com/MSW and enter code MSW. That's everlywell.com/MSW, code MSW, and you'll get 20% off your test. Everlywell, at-home lab tests, your answers, your way. What a child eats in his or her first years of life is critical to their healthy development. The nutrients that babies consume in their first 2 years go straight to their growing brain, bones, muscles, eyesight, digestion, you name it. So what you're feeding your kid really does matter, but you don't have to wreck yourself doing it at home. There's a company called Little Spoon, and they make it easy to keep your baby healthy. They're the only brand that's delivering 100% organic, non-GMO baby food and clean vitamins directly to your door. No preservatives, no additives. I also just learned that most baby food from the grocery store is older than your actual baby. What? I don't like that so much. There's a whole team of experts at Little Spoon who come up with recipes to make sure your baby is exposed to all kinds of superfoods for their healthy development. Little Spoon's baby food is always made in small batches, which means you're basically getting some really high quality homemade food. It uses over 100 USDA certified organic ingredients on a rotating menu of flavors and textures. The best part is that everything ships directly to your door and it doesn't break the bank. It's $3 or less a meal. Little Spoon sent a box to me and my kids were not down for eating it since the youngest one is 8. But I gave it to a neighbor who just had a baby and she said her daughter loved it. So no more worrying about what's in your baby's food. Little Spoon can take one thing off your to-do list and cover mealtime with their fresh organic blends. Get 20% off your first 3 orders at littlespoon.com/MSW. That's littlespoon.com/MSW. tell me about diagnoses. Are they helpful? Are they harmful?
I think there's a difference, a little bit difference between adult and a child. It's very hard to diagnose a child. I mean, children, like I said, the normality in a child is gigantic. Range, it's huge. So trying just to diagnose a child with, you know, something like, you know, saying like, a, you know, I've seen children as young as 6 or 7, someone had diagnosed them with bipolar disorder. I don't even know how that's even possible, you know, but, and so, and children, when they manifest those types of things, they don't manifest manic episodes. It looks different. I mean, now we have a whole new diagnosis with disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, which is a new one that's supposed to be kind of pediatric bipolar. It's in the new DSM because so many children are being diagnosed with a bipolar disorder. So, you know, the way children manifest psychiatric illnesses do not necessarily look the same as an adult. So depression in a child looks very similar to depression in an adult. They look very, very similar with some variations. You know, psychosis almost doesn't exist in children. It's so rare that you'd never see it. So it's a different thing. So diagnosis in a child is hard. Diagnosis in an adult can be very, very helpful, as it can diagnosis in a child, but diagnosis requires assessment. You know, this idea that psychiatry and psychology are kind of this, like, it's this kind of voodoo that you do, we kind of pull it out of the air. Like, I'm going to talk to you for 5 minutes and then I'm going to, you know, I analyzed you and I figured out what's going on. I mean, you know, I want a psychological assessment on a client that I see. I want them to sit down with somebody and be tested for several hours. Cognitive function, their personality. I want third-party reviewers to be interviewed. I want a report that says, this is what we found, and these are the criteria that this person meets. And so these are the diagnoses that they, I mean, that's how you do everything else. I mean, that's, you know, you get blood work, you get imaging, you get, so we have those kind of assessments in psychology and psychiatry. Unfortunately, they often aren't covered under insurance and they're expensive. And for some reason, a lot of people take shortcuts. Not a lot of psychiatrists will send someone out to get them assessed. I mean, they'll spend 45 minutes with them doing an intake assessment, which is great. You should. But they won't send them for a neuropsych assessment or, you know, things like that. They just go, okay, well, let's try this.
We did that for a child of mine. It was about 5 hours long, right, over a course of several days. And absolutely, we got a full, and it was expensive, but we got a lot of information.
Absolutely.
Some of which was sad. I mean, diagnoses can be, for me, it was a relief, but also there was a grieving process.
You never like to know that there's something wrong with your child. But, you know, if you, you know, diagnosis is a beginning. And good treatment comes from a good diagnosis, and as long as the person doing the treatment knows what they're doing. So it's, you know, I think that, you know, it's important to get that. I mean, ADHD is a perfect example. I mean, we have wonderful assessments for ADHD. You know, what is ADHD? Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So you're saying that the child has an attentional deficit, their attentional system is damaged or non-functioning, not functioning correctly, and or they have an impulse control problem. Okay. Well, we can test for those things. Or would you rather go in and tell your pediatrician, you know, the teacher said he can't sit still in his chair. Here, let's give him some amphetamines.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's laughable when you say it like that, but that's exactly what we're doing. You know, wouldn't you rather have a multi-page report where someone literally sat down with your child and assessed the tensional processes of their brain and said, hey, well, this system is working great, but this one seems to be a little slow or a little overactive or whatever. And being able to say, yes, he absolutely meets criteria for ADHD. So let's get him to a specialist who can put him on some medication and see how he does, as well as the fact that ADHD can be treated without medication. Behavior modification is tremendously effective for ADHD. In fact, children that receive behavior modification, oftentimes, if they have to take medication, take much less medication than children who don't receive behavior mod. Just like depression, for instance, in adults, depression and anxiety disorders can be fully treated without medication. Now, I'm not, you know, I love medication. I think medication is awesome, okay, when it's used correctly. And medication with therapy tends to be the better route. But we have a tendency to want a magic bullet pill. So we're going to give our kid a pill and they're going to be all good. Well, I don't want my child to have to take medication the rest of their life. I mean, wouldn't you rather that you retrain those systems in their brain so they might be able to get off that medicine? Same thing with depression and anxiety disorders. I would rather take the least amount of medicine I possibly could. So I'm going to get some therapy. And that's, again, that's why you need to go to somebody who is a mental health professional, a specialist. A pediatrician, you know, is like an internist for children. You know, I mean, they know a lot about childhood illnesses and stuff, but they know very little about mental health, just like you wouldn't let your child be treated for cancer by your pediatrician. So it's the same type of thing. And these things are treatable and they are manageable. And just because your child has a mental health care problem does not mean that it's a death sentence.
Yes. And I think some parents feel that way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. What would you say to a parent who just got a diagnosis that feels like cancer, but it turns out it is not, you know, maybe they're autistic or in our situation, we have attachment issues.
Right. No, I mean, I think that, you know, it depends on the diagnosis. I mean, obviously some are much worse than others. Some are lifelong conditions where others aren't. But I would also say this, you know, I have seen children with virtually every diagnosis you've ever imagined with families that engaged proper care, supported their child, got support from others to help them, that went on to have wonderful, happy lives, families, thriving. It doesn't mean that their children might not have some, you know, a child, for instance, has autism. A child who has autism is going to have some limitations their entire life. But I mean, in some sense, we all have limitations, but they may have more, but they certainly can have a wonderful, happy life and be a wonderful part of a family. They are a blessing of God. I mean, this is, you know, it's not a death sentence, but, you know, let's say a child is diagnosed with, you know, someone tells you that your 10-year-old kid has bipolar disorder, which again, I see a lot. First off, I question whether they really have bipolar disorder, but they obviously have some kind of psychological or psychiatric problem, okay? Are there treatments and medications that can help your child to manage and overcome those? Absolutely. Do you need to be the advocate for them and seek those out? Absolutely. But there is hope. There, you know, it would be the same thing as if your child were diagnosed with cancer. It's a different kind of mentality a lot of times. When a child's diagnosed with cancer or some illness, what we think of as a physical illness, you know, it becomes a fight. I'm going to fight for my child, you know. When it's a mental health problem, it's like, oh, well, that's it. They're done.
Isn't that interesting? Yes. And you want to tell everybody you know, like, we're in this fight together for their kidneys or
pray
whatever.
Pray for my kid. You know, let's raise money for our medical bills. You know, be praying for my child. You know, this, that, you know. But your kid gets diagnosed with a mental health condition and you isolate your entire family. You never tell anybody anything about it. It destroys you.
It feels very isolating. It can. Yeah. Because of the stigma of it. And as a mom with a kiddo with mental health issues, I don't ever want to bring them any shame. And unfortunately, there is a stigma around it. There shouldn't be any shame about having a mental health issue, but it just feels something that needs to be covered and hidden instead of.
Well, and there's a lot of misunderstanding. I mean, undoubtedly, there are people who blame you for your child's mental health problem. You're just a bad parent, or they're just a bad kid. There's no such thing as mental health issues. They're just a bad kid. If you just discipline them more or right, you know, and there is a shame, you know, then comes the idea that, well, she or he is broken mentally, so we should be afraid of them. So I don't want them in the Sunday school class. I don't want them next to my kid at, you know, in school. So,
and I have had friends who they don't want my kid around their kids, and it's hurtful.
Yeah, these are all, you know, they're untruths, they're myths, you know, and by doing them, we actually make the mental health of the child worse, you know, ultimately, and of the family. So, you know, I think it's a hard thing, but families need to be as honest, I think, with their families and friends as they can about their child's illness. They have to make it not some kind of a taboo secret. They have to talk about it. Because, you know, if you never talk about it, you never get to talk about the successes either, you know. Oh, she's doing so much better. You know, she's on this medication now. It's been incredible. Oh, you know, she was able to do this now and she's never been able to do that again. You never get to talk about those things.
That's such a good point.
You know, so I think you have to try to be as honest as you can. And I think you also have to be honest from the beginning. You know, I think if you're going to go into a new Sunday school class and, you know, your child has a history of acting out or whatever, I think you need to talk to the teacher about that ahead of time. Yes, there is the potential that they might be labeled, but it also is better to have that, you know, a supportive person on your side ahead of time than just kind of thing blows up in your face and you don't know what to do. Just ignoring it and hoping it's okay. I tend to find that doesn't work.
Yeah. So how would you say to talk to your child about their diagnosis or their struggles?
Well, you know, I think, again, I think it depends on what the issue is. If it has an obvious trigger, you know, I think that would be, you know, something to talk to them about. But I think also talking about it as if, how would you talk to them about if they had liver cancer? I mean, I think it's the same thing. You know, I think, you know, we have a brain in our head and, you know, if your kid has ADHD real bad, well, we all have attention, you know, describe to them what attention is, you know, maybe even show them a picture of a brain and say, you know, right now, your attentional systems haven't developed to the point where they should be. And that medication that you take helps you now, hopefully over time, it'll catch up and you won't have to take that anymore. It doesn't mean you've done anything wrong, but it's just, you know, it's an illness like any other. It's a disorder. So, and you compare it to things like diabetes or other chronic conditions where they understand, you know that Jimmy has diabetes and he has to take that shot every week. Well, it's the same kind of thing. It's just a different organ. And I think that's what you do. And I think, you know, you try to explain to them what the treatments do, you know, why they're important and why it's important that they engage them and be involved. But that also that there's nothing they've done and it doesn't make them any less of a person that, you know, God still cares for them, loves them, God's present with them, you know, and so, but also I think you have to explain to them that there's a stigma, you know, some people don't understand these things and, you know, I want you to tell me if anybody ever says anything to you that you wonder about or might be hurtful. But, you know, we love you and we're going to walk through this with you and hopefully one day this will just be a memory.
I love it. Yeah, that's good. I think sometimes the biggest struggle is the parent getting over their own problem with it being a diagnosis of their kid. I think kids have they don't have the stigma yet. Like they don't know to be upset about it. So,
right. The parents, they're shamed because it's like, I screwed up. My kid is broken. I mean, it's, you know what? It's not even that dissimilar to when a parent has a physically disabled child. There's a time you have to grieve your expectations and your dreams for that child that you had, and then you have to form new ones. And I think that it's the same thing. You know, if your child has some kind of mental health problem, you had an expectation for that child and dreams for that child, and that child may not be able to reach those expectations and dreams now, but there may be different or even better ones out there. And I think you have to let those go. And that's a mistake on the parents' fault. That's not and we all do that. We, you know, maybe I have the expectation that my kid's going to play in the NFL, but he's not good enough. Well, if I hold him to that standard, that's only going to damage our relationship. So it's not like this is something that we all deal with it at some level. It's just magnified when there's a mental health problem.
Yeah. So resources that you have created are Grace for the Children and then Grace for the Afflicted, which is for adults. I love these books and they're really, really helpful. So I would really recommend those to anybody who this is something you're dealing with. But so in this season of sheltering in place and all this together time that makes you want to run out of your house and never look back, what would you say is helpful for people to reclaim and regain and keep their sanity?
So I think during this time, this kind of shelter in place or isolate yourself, I think a lot of people will, they just think, well, we just kind of stop everything. We stay in our house until it's over. And then we go on. Well, we all know that being isolated is not healthy and just staying in your house all the time is not healthy. So first thing you need to do is you need to develop a structure for your day. You know, you have a structure for your day when you go to work and your child goes to school. You have to have a structure for your day now. So, you know, try to get people up at about the same time, try to go to bed at about the same time, try to, do you eat breakfast? Do you, you know, when are we going to work on our homework? Do we put in, we have some opportunity for, exercise and think fun things. I mean, so you need to have a structure for the day, not just kind of like, you know, haphazard, like let's just do whatever we do. And maybe we'll, otherwise you just end up sleeping around all the time.
True.
And you're just sleeping on the couch. So you have to have some kind of structure. I also think that you need to really reinvest in kind of, connection opportunities. So, you know, if you don't normally eat dinner together, guess what? It's time to eat dinner together, you know, and it's time to, not everybody goes in the kitchen and just kind of puts their own thing together. You know, you eat dinner together or eat lunch together, try to do something together, go for a walk together, you know, a couple times a week, be more engaged and involved with your children's schoolwork, you know, even if they don't want your help, ask them, okay, well, you do it then and I'll check over it. I mean, I want to see what you're doing. I want to be involved. So I think you have to develop structure and routine. You just absolutely have to engage family time. If you haven't done that in the past, it's time to do it. You know, play games. You're never going to get a greater opportunity in your life than this right now. You know, and so I think those things make a huge difference. I also think you have to really practice a lot of self-care. I mean, if you're anxious, then you need to limit the amount of news that you're, you know, don't sit there with a 24-hour-a-day news cycle, especially if you have children. I mean, children are terrified right now. They don't know what's going on. They don't know the difference between a 3% mortality and a 100% mortality of a disease. They don't know what's going on. So try to explain to them. But don't just have the news on all day and be trying to pull all that garbage in. Limit your news that you get. Get it from a trusted source that's going to give you the news, not a commentary. Don't just spend all day on your phone or on the internet. Read, exercise. I mean, if you're an anxious person, then you definitely want to exercise as much as possible. You want to stay away from caffeine. You want to be careful what you're eating. I just saw an article the other day that they said, you've heard of the freshman 15. Well, welcome to the quarantine 15. So people are sitting at home snacking because they emotionally are eating. So you need to be real careful about that and careful about that for your children. Again, that's just part of being connected, prepare meals together, limit the kind of snacks you have in your household. So I just think it's about being very intentional. I think you just need to be, it isn't just a time just to shut everything off and kind of run to each other's room. I think it's time to be very intentional and be connected to one another.
Yeah, that's so good. It's all really good stuff. Thank you, Matt, for your work and for what you do at the Hope and Healing Center. Thank you for writing these books. Yes. Ladies, I hope you were encouraged by that conversation. As a mom of a kiddo with mental health issues, as somebody who struggles with her own mental health like I do, I think it's important to talk about these things. It is very, very possible to struggle with mental health and still love God. I hope that you hear that loud and clear. If you haven't already, I feel like I say that every single week. And I think I just wanted to leave you with this. Matt talked a lot about checking our preconceived notions about where our kids should be. And I think if your kids are struggling with mental health or if they're just different than you thought, we can look at our precious little babies and think, oh, I want them to grow up and be whatever they want to be or whoever they want to be or however they want to be. But then when they actually start going away, that you're like, I didn't see that coming. We can think we have no expectations, but we have expectations. So maybe you struggle well this week by just considering, where are you really afraid for your kid? Where are you very uncomfortable with something that you're seeing? Where do you just, if you're very honest, and probably not honest to them, but if you're very honest in your heart, you wish they were a little different in this one way? Perhaps. Maybe you struggle well this week by bringing that to the Lord and asking Him to give you a different perspective. When He made our children, He did not make a mistake. We love that when we think about us. When He made us, He made no mistake. But then when we think about our kids, we're like, but really? Maybe a little? Things are going awry. But He didn't. He has a great track record of perfection. And no offense, but you don't. And I don't. All right, ladies, please join me on social media. Really, I love Instagram. come over to Mom Struggling Well and let's struggle well together. Because remember, perfection is nonsense and peace is a perspective shift away. Let me pray for us. Lord, thank you that you don't make mistakes. I pray for children who do struggle with their mental health. I do pray that you would help us to use the provision of medication if that is something that would be beneficial. God, I pray for moms who feel like they don't know if they should medicate and if they shouldn't. A lot of times I think that us moms feel like once we make that choice, we can't ever go back. Lord, I pray that you'd help us to all remember we've never done this before. You know that we've never done this before. You promised to give us wisdom if we asked for it. And so I do pray for wisdom. And I also pray for perspective. If a mom tries a thing and it doesn't work, can always stop the medication. It's beautiful in that way. So Lord, I pray for freedom, that we would not be bound by fear. I pray for all of us to look at our kids with a fresh set of eyes. God, would you help us to see our kids the way you see them? That we wouldn't just look at the things that don't quite possibly measure up to what we thought or to what we hoped. God, I think we put on top of our kids a really heavy burden to be something else. And I don't think that is what you would want. And I don't think that you do that for us. So Lord, I pray for lightness this week in exchanges between these moms who are struggling well and their kiddos. Thank you, Lord. Amen.